Okay, chapter one, page one, let's begin.
The mouth is a weird place. Not quite inside and not quite out, not skin and not organ, but something in between. Dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate. Where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up.
That's Max Wall from Portland, Oregon, getting us started with the story of To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, a novel by Joshua Ferris.
I loved it. I thought it was interesting in terms of the interpersonal relationships. Ferris has a real way with humor, and he has a real way with setting a scene with very minimal description.
Max is one of the gentlemen in the Portland's Gentlemen's Club, a real book club founded by another gentleman, Tim Sands.
I love the book pretty much from the first pages. It started off, you know, pretty funny and then got into a lot of searching and came to a good end.
I enjoyed the book a lot. I thought it sort of told two different stories to me. One was the search that this guy was having, Paul was having, for who he is and how he can find his way. And at the same time, there was a little bit of the mystery aspect in it.
And that's one more of our Portland gentlemen, John Loheis, on the book To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris, the first book in the Takeaway Book Club series, where every month we'll pick one piece of fiction to read and discuss. Today's book tells the story about Paul C. O'Rourke, a successful New York dentist who is lost, lonely, and kind of miserable. Not a typical navel-gazing story, more of a molar-gazing epic. Paul O'Rourke's passion is being a Boston Red Sox fan, which doesn't cut it as spiritual wisdom. His search for truth is a fairly dismal series of relationships with women of different religions. These don't go well. And in a twist, religion finds him when someone steals his identity online and draws him into a search for the roots of a bizarre, ancient, or possibly cult religion. To Rise Again at a Decent Hour was a great book for this trio, whose interests include mathematics, music, the law, fly fishing, and, of course, their book club.
It was a good excuse for us. We've got some new fathers. We've got a bunch of lawyers and journalists and writers that we wanted a good place to get together and drink whiskey, wear funny hats, and actually kind of use a little bit of intellect to have, a common cultural heritage book-wise. So we've been getting together for about 4 years. We usually have food, drink, beer, and whiskey are popular. But the food varies. You know, we're not trying to start an arms race like some book clubs where everybody ones up each other, you know.
Another great thing is, this is Max, another great thing is that, Tim picked a book this past time that I would never have heard of. And it's a real chance for us to expand reading, because there's books that I would never have in a million years thought of reading that these guys have picked that have been great books.
This is an example of that for me, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. And thanks for letting me in on your club and all of our listeners. We've got a few who already have some comments on the book. What do you think Joshua Ferris is getting at here with this story of a dentist on a search who's very conflicted really is sort of lost in the universe?
For me, I think the narrator is just trying to find his place in the world. You know, he's a pretty successful dentist. And outwardly, he's got all the signs of success. You know, he's got a nice place in New York, and he's got money to go out and grab great meals. But
Curry
at the same time, he's just a lonely guy. He can't relate to anyone in one of the busiest cities of the world.
You know, and John, one thing that hit me too is that it's almost like he has his wheel of life, but he's trying to find one spoke to carry the entire wheel. And it's that kind of searching throughout, whether it's looking at religion or his iPhone, his me machine, what's going to carry him through life. And he keeps trying to find some sense of community, at least was my takeaway, I guess, that by the end of the book, by joining with this other kind of religious non-religion, but he's still able to have that sense of community, that sense of togetherness and meeting with people, talking about things, and a group to be together with. And in a way, it made me think a lot of our book club. This is our way of having fellowship and community and meeting with each other. So the notion of finding commonality with other people, even if it's through fraudulent websites, it worked for me.
Yeah, it wasn't so much about the religion for me. It was just another way that he was able to develop his own sort of sense of identity and self and kind of find his place in the world.
Well, you know, he finds the religious experience in the oddest places. I want you to just know that there's a member of your club now from Grand Prairie, Texas, and this is this person's reaction. The book really pointed out how separated we are in spite of the great number of people on the earth. Interesting how people want to be a part of something larger than themselves, just what you were talking about, whether it is the Amalekites, a fan group, or an internet group. People sure are disconnected despite always being connected to their me machines.
Yeah, I think that theme was one thing that jumped out at me right away. Really just the satire and emphasizing how flimsy technology is as a way to connect, you know, that somebody was able to steal his identity by just going online, starting a website, and all of a sudden that person is Paul C. O'Rourke, you know. And so how kind of flimsy that technology is for establishing those sorts of contacts. There was a lot of emphasis on that point, and it's very true, and it's something we're the first generation to have to try to navigate is how do you work that sort of flimsy technology in a way that you actually get something foundational and something real in community. And that's not a resolved question, I think, at this point.
No, no.
And so it was an interesting thing to bring up in the book.
One thing I noticed with what Tim was talking about was, at least with the advent of things like Facebook, I've noticed that I'm having more communication with people, but it's of a more shallow nature. You know, we're having quick text message conversations. We're not having lengthy discussions. I've started trying to write more real letters in an attempt to try and see if I can deepen my conversations. It made me think a lot of there's a guy named Bo Lozoff who started the Human Kindness Foundation. One thing that Mr. Lozoff really professed was that the answers are the deep and simple. The problem is that the world that we're living in is shallow and complex. And that kept coming back to me as I was reading the book, that he's living in this world that is so one thing to the next, second after second after second. And what he really needed was deep, simple connections with people.
And yet each time he tries that, you know, he messes it up. And it's almost hard to read, and especially in the first part of the book, because every time he gets into a relationship, it's just like, oh, come on, Paul. Like, you want him to do better, and yet he doesn't repeatedly.
And you know, one thing I noticed, John, you know, when I was reading through this, there's a section where he starts defining himself not as Paul, but as Paul who loves Connie, all in dashes, all one word. And I actually, this is the first book in a while that I've had to stop several times and think about what I'm reading because it was causing me to think so much about myself and be introspective, which is a little unusual for me. And that once he's in love, he loses his sense of self, and that takes away from your partner whatever they had to love about you in the first place. It's like they're looking into a mirror. And I can think of at least one relationship that I've ruined that way. And so for me, it was kind of a, oh, yeah, moment, and like, oh, well, I need to make sure I don't do that again.
Yeah, and I think Max hits on a good point there that, you know, hopefully, you know, no one who's reading this, I think, identifies 100% with everything about what Paul's going through, but I think there were so many just great elements of Josh's writing that, like, I mean, I think everybody who's read it that I've talked to has found at least one or two elements where you're like, I absolutely know, you know, that lotion tirade, like, I understand, you know, where he's coming from on there. And, you know, and I think we all react to it differently, but I think some of the plausibility of the story gets bolstered by the fact that, you know, that there's at least a couple elements where we can all say, I've done that, you know, maybe not as 100% as Paul does, but it was very relatable, I think, in that way for me.
Give me a hint of the lotion tirade.
Well, there was one of his exes who he was gripped by quite strongly was putting on lotion. He spent, I think, probably 10 minutes just staring at her until she kind of called him out, like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Oh, I wish at some point you would have taught me about lotion." And he's like, "She's like, there's nothing to teach. You just put it on, you feel good." And he won't trust it. And he keeps, and that seemed to be a kind of a theme. He keeps wanting to try to dissect everything to the point where he can really, in a very rational way, deal with it. And you know, I think the one of the things he gets to is that by the end, you don't get happy by dissecting and understanding perfectly everything. You get happy by letting it go. You know.
Well, and Tim, one thing I noticed too is that he's so cyclical in terms of his superstitions, and he has to do the same thing every time the Red Sox are on, and he has to walk out in the sixth inning, and he has to eat the chicken and rice, and he has to do everything a specific way. And in a way, it's like compartmentalizing his life to the point where he's not actually living anymore. And by the end of the book, when he finally gives in to trying something new, or having experiences, that to me, I mean, it was very uplifting to me at the end. And I didn't expect this to be an uplifting book in any way at all.
Here's a woman listener from Normandy Park, Washington, Gina Howell Forbes. I found the book to be a fascinating character study of a psychologically troubled middle-aged man. I loved his growth and his increasing understanding of himself throughout the story. I spent a good deal of time wondering what psychiatric diagnosis could be applied to him. I did a little of that. And what sorts of treatment might benefit him. I did not like the ending of the book at all. I felt I wasted the time I'd spent reading the book when I got to the end and nothing was resolved and nothing really changed for him. I'm hoping that by listening and reading the discussion, I can figure out what I missed. Can you help Jenna here?
Well, you know, I think that what I felt was so hopeful at the end is that he has realized that he doesn't have to be this person that he's stuck being anymore. You know, he can go. He's still going to do the charity work in Kathmandu, and he's able to help people out. He's able to have a human interaction with these children at the end, and he's able to just give it a go and try hitting the ball in cricket. You know, I'm flipping ahead here, but he says when he realizes that he doesn't have to root for the Red Sox, he can root for the Cubs because they're even more of a failure.
He loves suffering.
That's the religious point. I mean, is rooting for the Cubs a religious, spiritual upgrade from rooting for the Red Sox? Does it involve more faith?
I think it depends upon what your faith is based on. If your faith is based on, yay, we're the top, you know, you go root for the Yankees, but all good Americans hate the Yankees. So I think that the Cubs.
Not controversial at all.
If you're rooting for the Cubs, you're rooting because you want, I mean, you want to be like Job. You want to put up with all of the suffering because at the end of the day, if that's what brings you joy. But it's the notion of, he said, you know, the world knew again, something to desperately want. I went inside and when I came back out, it was on my head where my Red Sox hat had been for years. And he swings at the cricket bat and he says, what the hell, I thought, what the hell? And without any expectation or understanding, doubtful of any hope of success, I swung, one eye on the ball and one eye toward heaven. And to me, that says, whether it's baseball or cricket, you take your chances and you may have doubts, but you still take your chances at the end of the day. And by actually moving forward and doing something and not just thinking about his superstitions, he is able to, I think, begin to overcome those superstitions and begin to still have doubts, but to move forward in his life. And that, to me, was why it was so uplifting. Well, I don't know if you fellas have any other ideas.
No, I mean, but I don't want to, you know, give out too many spoilers, but I did like the way that the book wrapped up. I know that there's various opinions on, you know, how crisp and clean an ending should be. But, you know, this one, for me, didn't seem like he went through some vast transformation and, you know, enemies become friends and friends become enemies. It was a little more, I felt, subtle and realistic. So the ending to me suggested he went from Paul O'Rourke, you know, depressed all the time, to basically the same Paul O'Rourke, but with some small changes. And that scale, I think, is something that he hadn't done in his life, that everything seemed to be complete replacement of his identity.
That's right. Yeah, he's doing volunteer work overseas. It sounds like he's gone and done that a few times, and he's gone with one of the people that he works with. And it seemed to me like he had developed a pretty good friendship with that person. It sort of developed some mutual respect. And then, you know, he's in the streets of Kathmandu, and he sees this kid with a great smile, and he realizes, oh, that's the work that I've done. I've made a difference in someone's life. And he kind of gets outside of his own head. And to me, that was pretty uplifting.
Well, and I thought too, John, that the interesting thing to me was his kind of realization, I think, that identity is fluid. I mean, you can make yourself into what you want to be. You can, you know, create your own Facebook page, your website, turn yourself into who you want to be. And if you want to be a Cubs fan, I guess that's okay.
And there was the Thoreau quote about, you know, the greatest gift man has is the ability to raise your life by conscious endeavor. And I think, you know, once you get that mindset, then you're right. I mean, I think there weren't any like actual relationships we pointed, like, here's his new best friend and here's his, you know, new love interest and here's that. But he's at least got the ability to have that momentum change. And I think that's, you know, that's as hopeful as you can get for a lot of cases.
So what do you think? Should we keep going with this book club thing? This is pretty cool.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and like, I mean, you know, just getting, you know, it's getting harder and harder with the internet to get everybody kind of on the same page, you know, no pun intended. So, you know, having having people kind of commit to doing that is, I think, it's been a great thing for our community, you know, here in Portland, but also nationwide. I think there's a lot of good opportunity for it.
Well, and who knows? Maybe you'll get some hors d'oeuvres FedEx to you from Grand Prairie, Texas, or Normandy Park, Washington, or Central Massachusetts.
Yeah, it is possible to ship barbecue, and you know, if anything's coming from Texas, that would be a welcome thing.
Well, Tim Sands, Max Wall, and John Lohuis, thanks for talking about Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's been great.
Thanks, John. Yeah,
thanks very much, John.
A big thanks to the Portland Gentlemen's Club, our first book club in our ongoing book club series. And when they aren't reading books, here's them playing some bluegrass music.
He's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories when everything was as fresh as the bright blue sky.
And we want to remind you how to take part in this book club project of ours, not their band, although they'd be happy to have you. You can nominate your book club by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. And even if you don't have a book club but want to read along with us, you can find a list of the books we're reading at thetakeaway.org. Our next book is Sleep Donation by Karen Russell. It's an e-book only, so take a look for it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.